Oxen, Villefort. Yes, you were saying about the huts and how crowded they were to get out to roll call.
That's right. Now, the reason for these roll calls was that they had to count every single prisoner, and that had to tally with the total population of the camp. But of course, things always got mixed up because you never knew which hut you belonged to, or shall we say you forgot which hut you belonged to. And so things had to tally, and that took a very, very long time. The people who were in charge of the hut had to count their own population, as it were, and submit this to the SS personnel who would come and do their own count. And sometimes they had something like an escape. And if that happened, the whole camp would stand roll call until this person was recaptured, and sometimes it was 24 hours. Well, what happened is that the people just died standing up because you were standing in the cold, in the hot, and when it was snowing, when it was raining, when the sun was blazing. And that went on morning, and that was twice a day. That was morning and night. Morning before the parties went out to work, and then when work parties came back to the camp, they again stood roll call. After roll call, there was a sort of a period of commotion, shall we say, in between the roll call and the curfew, because there was a curfew. You see, after the roll call, a few minutes, and then you were shut in for the night. Now, when I say shut in, I think I must just go back, perhaps, to my first night in Auschwitz. We were first shut into this hut, and it was because it was total darkness, because there was no electricity in the huts themselves. It was just this little skylight. My mother and I scrambled onto a bunk, and when I say bunk, it was a three-tier bunk, each holding about eight people, and you sort of lay. I mean, if you couldn't lie anywhere, you were sitting on what we used to call a heating channel, which wasn't really a heating channel. It was just a concrete channel, and people used to sit on there during the night because they had nowhere to lie down. Well, you could buy yourself a place to sleep if you had something to barter. Well, my mother and I managed to scramble onto a bunk, and in the morning when these whistles blew, yes, that's right, and the person that I was lying to, it turned out she was a gypsy. That's right. And, she looked terribly ill, actually, at that stage already. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, you've only just come. Oh, give me your hand." And she sort of looked at my hand and she said, "You're going to come out of here." That's the first night that happened to me. She said, "You're going to come out of here." And I said, I didn't know what she was talking about. And I lay next to her. And then the next morning, I shook her get up, and I realized she died in the night, and I was terribly cold that night, so I remember absolutely freezing. I was lying next to this dead body, and that was the sort of the first night. And so the next morning, well, everybody started rushing out, and I said to my mother, "Look, this gypsy has died." I said, I know what we've got to do. We've got to take her clothes, because we were absolutely freezing. We were only allowed one layer of clothes. And I said, "Look, it's no good to her. You see, she's dead now, and this is what we must do. When somebody dies, you've got to take it off them, because we must have something. We must have another layer, and if we do have something, we can change it. We can might be able to buy something for it." Well, she said, "Yes, maybe that's the thing." And this came to me at that stage. It was the very first night that that's the way to live in this place. When people die, you must try and have something of these people, but you must not touch it if they're alive. Yes, that was very important. And my mother said, "I remember, you know, these people are alive. Well, if anybody's alive, you must never take anything of anybody. But when they're dead, it's yours, because it's no good to these people. They're going to strip them anyway. And we saw bodies lying on heaps already. They're all stripped." She said, "That's the thing to do. You must have anything that this person has." And of course, this gypsy had one or two bread rations tucked away, and some clothes, and we took this. So immediately the next day, we had a double ration of bread. And I realized then that was absolutely vital. If you can't get into a... Well, we saw some women well-dressed, you see, and well... and they had proper shoes and proper clothes, and they seemed to have proper occupations as well. And it was immediately transpired that if you've got to find a place of work where there were better conditions, where you could get away from being beaten, from being harassed by other prisoners. And it also came to me that if you were presentable, people wouldn't actually put upon you, you see. Perhaps I ought to explain the hierarchy that existed in this camp and a little bit about the organization of Auschwitz itself. I did explain that there were two parts of Auschwitz, and the two main complexes possibly had about 22 different sections, different camps, where each one, its own section, had its own barbed wire, electrified fences, so you couldn't go from one place to another. All exits were patrolled. They were not patrolled by the SS. They were patrolled by other prisoners, because you had this hierarchy of prisoners. There was a woman in, of course, there was a commandant who was the SS commandant, and he had his subordinates, he had his helpers, and he had a lot of women, SS women, who had different duties in the camp. But the overall running of the whole entire camp was left to the ruling prisoners. And mostly they were German prisoners, different categories of prisoners. And they all had different markings on their clothes, so you knew who they were. The Poles had red markings on the P, and the Jews had huge red crosses on their backs, so you immediately knew which were the Jewish prisoners. Huge long stripes on the backs. The German prisoners, criminal categories, for instance, had black triangles, so you knew they were. Criminal category, and the political prisoners, I think, had a red triangle. So the German political prisoners were also distinguished from the criminal categories. But the ruling prisoners were the criminal category. They all had these black triangles. So they were actually in charge. They were the capos, heads of working parties. And of course, they were also in charge of the living quarters, the barracks, the actual blocks. I can't tell you too much about the quarantine period, which was the first 6 weeks of the camp, because it was just a matter of hiding and getting away from everybody else, mostly from the ruling prisoners, who took it upon themselves, of course, to grab people for work, because they needed work parties to, I don't know, carry excreta, carry bodies, dig trenches within the camp at that stage. Then they began to allocate people to different work parties after the sort of 6 weeks. In other words, that was your initiation to the camp, the first 6 weeks. And it sorted people out who could survive and who didn't at that stage already. After 6 weeks, this person who tattooed us actually came back and looked for my mother. She promised to come, and she did. And she took my mother away and said, "I'm going to get you to work in the hospital compound." Well, it wasn't a hospital as we know it at all. It was a sick bay, but people weren't actually treated there. Although we had prisoner doctors there, they had no means of treating people. In fact, it was a very dangerous place to be, unless you were actually working there. And my mother was taken to work there, and she was her duty was mostly to carry out bodies and do some cleaning. You couldn't actually do it because there wasn't any running water. Certainly trying to help people, to talk to them, and if you could, give them some water to drink. But that's the sort of nursing that you could do. However, it was an enormous help, because she didn't have to stand the twice daily roll calls outside.
They did take her alcohol inside, and she wasn't liable for selections because there were selections to the crematoria almost daily. You know, different huts were surrounded, and what they used to call Blocksperre is to make a curfew, put them all into a hut, and the sections were carried out. Now, this is where your anticipation came into, you know, you had to anticipate what was going to happen. If you saw a group of SS coming into the camp, you usually began to feel as it was a bad omen. You knew something was going to happen. You didn't quite know what. You knew you had to keep away and be at the other side if you could. It wasn't always possible. You had no, there was no free movement even within the small enclosure that you were. I tried desperately to get away from work outside. I mean, there was a long period where I couldn't do that. I was taken to work outside, digging trenches, carrying the cement, actually helping to lay the railway that eventually extended from the gate of Auschwitz to the Birkenau all the way to the crematoria. So I was working on that railway. I wasn't actually carrying the railway, I was carrying bags of cement, I remember. So I was working outside for a long period, and I knew that this couldn't go on. I couldn't possibly survive working on external work like this. I was getting weaker by the day, and I was being beaten, and dogs were set upon us, and of course there wasn't enough food. And gradually I managed to get into different work groups. At one time I worked actually carrying excreta, which was a very good occupation at the time, because I explained there were no lavatories. There was a hut with great big holes, and all this stuff had to be dug out and put into buckets and then tipped into a cesspit. And also we carried bodies, and I worked doing all manner of work. But then what I tried very hard to do is to get into a work group, the party that worked, a work party that worked in Siemens. There was a Siemens plant, but it was a very difficult, you know, you couldn't actually get into a work party. Like I said, there were already a certain number of people there. But what I did find that they wore specific clothes. They had the striped dresses, which we normally didn't have, and they wore certain headscarves. And I thought, well, if I could look like them, I could actually pretend that I was working there, although I didn't. And in that way, I could. They had a day shift and a night shift. And I thought, well, the best thing to do in this whole place is to actually do nothing if you can. Just get out of all work, because then if you could hide, you'd conserve your energy if you could. You could sleep when everybody was working. And you could keep away from all the people that were liable to beat you up. Because my mother, being in the hospital, was isolated from me, because this part of Birkenau was subdivided into, there were so many different divisions of Birkenau. There was sort of what was known as B1 and B2 and B1B and B1C and divisions like this. And in between were electrified fences and patrolled by the ruling prisoners, and there were sort of gates. Yeah. So you always had to get through these gates, because you couldn't go anywhere near the electric fence. If you went too close to the fence, it would actually draw you, and so you could only go as far as a trench. If it would draw you, and you'd in fact commit suicide. So, or if you came too close, you were shot at from the watchtowers that surrounded the barbed wire. So you couldn't go too close. So I always had somehow to go and see get to see what my mother was doing, to see how she was getting on. And occasionally that was possible when there was a small commotion, when people were trying to find their hut to stand roll call, and there was this commotion. And during this commotion, you try to find your friends, or you try to see, I tried to get to my mother. And that was also the time when you tried to get into a lavatory hut. At that stage, they had these holes, you know, mostly without success, because there was one hut and there must have been about 20,000 women trying to get in. So that was actually a losing battle, and most people actually gave up. And you couldn't get access to water at that stage at all. That was my first year in Auschwitz. I also found that another good way to survive was to find a group, to form a group, two or three people. One person alone was a very difficult thing to survive. You had to have friends. That was absolutely essential. And what's more, you had to have friends who were prepared to do everything for you, to risk their own lives all the time for you, and you do the same for them. That's the sort of friendship that you were looking for, and that's the sort of friendship that you found. And you also formed friendships with people who had something to give, to contribute, if they worked in a place where they could. Everything was to organize. In other words, was to steal. There was one word to organize. To organize food, to organize drink, to organize water. Those are the essential things that you had to have. And you could only have that if anyone had access to a place. And you could exchange this and you could contribute. But as I said, for a long time, I actually did nothing. I did manage to barter long enough to look like the Siemens workers. And for a time, I used to walk in with a night shift, and when they came in, they stood the roll call. They all stood the roll call in our places. When the roll call was finished, I used to get in with them, with the night shift, the Siemens night shift, get into their hut and get a ration of bread. You see, well, go in with them. And then when during the next morning, it was again roll call, I had to go back to my block, stand roll call. And then I used to again go in with a day shift. In the evening I used to go in with the day shift. So I used to sleep with the night shift all day. And then I used to sleep with the day shift all night. You see? I used to try and do that. And that worked for a time. I know I couldn't do that for long, but because I did realise that I was sort of on my own. And if anything happened to me, well, you know, that would be the end. So I did realise we have to form a family. And we did eventually form a group, and one girl was working, I don't know, I think it was actually distributing bread, where they were cutting up bread, so that was very good contact. And I think I worked digging potatoes at that time. Well, that was quite a good contact, because I used to smuggle in potatoes. And so we'd actually eat a lot of potatoes, you see, because sometimes we managed to light a fire, which is forbidden, and actually cook some soup. But most of it was raw potatoes, and I used to smuggle in these potatoes. So I had something to contribute, she had something to contribute. Another one worked in a sauna where they had access to water and clothes. So she used to smuggle in a little bit of clothes. And so you bartered and tried to get by. Well, that went on for some months and months and months. But of course, I really must say something about a delousing session. As you know, because there was no access to water, I actually hadn't washed for 12 months. I hadn't. My body was completely grey, covered in a kind of scabies from top. We used to call it scabies from top to bottom, which was very dangerous because for selection, you know, that's the first thing they look for if your body wasn't clean. And I was completely covered in lice, which, and in fact, if we did have any time, the time was spent delousing each other, you know, just trying to get rid of these lice. Now, they had a policy of delousing in Birkenau, and what they did is they would surround one hut and get everybody out, which is sort of, I'm talking about 1,000 women at the time, push them into this so-called sauna, take all their clothes off them. A little bit of water would dribble out. You didn't even get wet because there were so many people to one possible shower. And then you couldn't possibly clean yourself up. But then you were smeared with this green fluid. Well, normally, they take all your clothes and they give you all the clothes. And of course, you lost all. See, you had two or three layers of clothes. You lost all that. And you were back to square one with one set of clothes. Well, one particular delousing session I really need to tell you about, and that happened during the winter. What happened there is we were taken into this delousing chamber, and they took all the clothes off us. And when we came out, we were waiting for the clothes, because there weren't any clothes. They were told our clothes were wet, and they haven't been dried. And so we were put into the hut, and we thought, oh, well, we're going indoors, so we'll wait for the clothes. But when we got into the hut, they had removed all the straw mattresses, because they took those to be deloused, and all the blankets, and they were just bare boards, and about 1,000 naked women. And the clothes that were disinfected were thrown on the roof of the hut. And we they were told, you're going to get these clothes when they're dry. Well, of course, that was winter. And we still had to stand roll call naked twice a day during that time. And I would tell you that our hut almost emptied at that point, because people just, they died of cold. Their feet were frozen to the ground, some people's feet. We sort of huddled together. That's how we kept warm. You know, people were just sticking one body next to the other.
How about yourself on that occasion? You know, how did you?
I just kept on telling myself I'm not feeling cold. You know, it was kind of self-hypnosis all the time. You know, if one said, you know, I'm not feeling cold. I must go through this. Sooner or later we'll get the clothes. Well, it just happened. Sooner or later somebody got up a ladder and they threw all the clothes down, which was still wet. But what happened was there were so few of us left that everybody had about 3 or 4 layers of clothes at that time, but wet clothes, not clean, of course. They were supposed to have been disinfected, but you know, we were covered in lice just the same. They, of course, every time you were deloused, they shaved your head as well. So you were, by that time, my hair was already quite long, and I had all my hair shaved. In fact, they didn't shave it; they cut it with scissors. You know, so you had sort of tufts of hair all over your head. Anyway.
How long was that in all, do you reckon, that you were without clothes? Do you know?
I think it was 3 days. I think it was 3 days before we got these clothes. Yeah. We were shut in there for 3 days. And you see, because it taught me one lesson, never again such a delousing. So whenever these delousing sessions, you know, that's how you learn, by your experience. If something happened to you, you know you mustn't happen to you a second time, because you've never survived it the second time. So you learned quickly enough that, God, at first I thought, oh, delousing, that'd be good, because I'm clean up. But it wasn't so, you didn't know that. So you learned as you went along, you had to be away from certain situations. So when there was a rumour that was going to be delousing, you were damn sure that you weren't anywhere near. We were miles away. Anyway, I think shortly after this delousing, I actually got ill, you see. And of course, you know, I think I just collapsed. I kept on saying, take me to my mother, I must go to my mother's block. I think it was block 29 or something, in the hospital block. And they carted me off, actually, to my mother. And I still had typhus at that stage. I got typhus. Now, years before, even in the Lublin ghetto, I recall, my father had us immunized against typhus early on in the war. And if it hadn't been for that, we would have never survived typhus. Because both my mother had typhus later, at a later stage as well. I don't remember very much of the time I had typhus, because I was unconscious for quite a long time. You can have a very high fever. I know I was put in a bunk. One person had scarlet fever, one had diphtheria, one had... all four of us had a different infectious disease. And I had typhus, so we were all lying in one bunk. And we didn't all get each other's diseases. That was strange, because I had never had scarlet fever or diphtheria, but I didn't get it. And I had the typhus. Anyway, because fortunately my mother was there, and she couldn't do anything for me except just give me water now and again and tie me to the bed, to the actual, because you were delirious and you were trying to get off and trying to get out. In fact, her main occupation was trying to get people to stay in so they didn't get out, because they were not allowed to get out, you see, and everybody was fighting to get outside. So I was, you get all kinds of hallucinations apparently, and this is what happened. I used to scream all these oranges had to pluck them off my bed and nobody wants to pass them to me. My mum said, and of course I didn't recognise my mother at all, you know, I was delirious for weeks, I believe, and there were some selections to the guest chamber while I was sick. And on one occasion, my mother actually put me underneath a body and put a straw mattress on top, and I think a body on top, to keep me completely out of view. There was one selection, and the other selection was when Mengele came, and I was already sort of convalescent. I had all kinds of other things that happened after typhus. I got infections in both my ears, and I got pneumonia, and I just couldn't recover. But there was this selection, and everybody had to get out in front of Mengele, and my mother said, "You've got to run, because if you're going to crawl and walk," because I was still on my knees, I was still walking, you know. And she said, "You've got to stand up straight, and not only that, you have to run when you come in front of him." She cleaned me up, and I did. I actually ran, you know. And somebody turned me around twice, because I was fairly emancipated. You know, I'd lost a lot of weight by then. And he sort of put me to one side. And so, you know, I was still lived, but half the block by that time was emptied.
Did you know at that time what that meant?
At that time we knew what it meant, yes. We knew because there were selections for the crematoria all the time. And what's even worse, part of the camp was, there was a section called Block 25, which was a block and an enclosure. And we didn't know that after people were selected within the camp, they put them into this Block 25 and they held them there sometimes 2 or 3 days without food and water. Just like a holding thing, and sometimes just in the enclosure itself. And you couldn't go anywhere near there, it was out of bounds, and people were screaming for food and water. And then we saw them loaded up and taken to the crematoria. So we didn't know the crematoria there, but we've not been anywhere near at that stage. I have not been to this particular part of the camp, but we could see the flames and the smoke, and we knew where these people were going. In any case, you were told all the time, you know, there's only one way out of here, and that's via the chimney. But you were not allowed to talk about it. If it got word, even to the ruling prisoners, the crematoria and this. Oh no, that's when we don't know anything about crematoria. Oh no, there's no getting here. You know, they pretended. They were not allowed to talk about it at all. So, but you did know at that stage, you already knew, yes, what there was. It took a long time before it actually sunk in. But by that time, yes. And of course, we saw people being brought in, don't forget. We saw people coming in. Trains were being unloaded on the ramp, which was just by the hospital enclosure. So from there, you could actually see people being thrown out of the cattle tracks, lined up and being selected and being segregated, some into the camp and some straight to the gas chamber. So at that stage, yes, we already knew, and we already knew how dangerous it was to be in the hospital. And because of there were selections daily in the hospital itself.
You've mentioned a man called Mengele.
Yes.
Who was he?
Oh, yes. Well, Dr. Mengele, of course, we had quite a lot of SS doctors who carried out experiments on prisoners. There was a large experimental station, they used to call it, in Auschwitz I. I've never been there myself. But different SS doctors carried out different research. Mostly their own researches, which they were particular things they happened to be interested in. This man Mengele was particularly interested in twins. So whenever transports would arrive, he would stand on the ramp of the unloading platform, and he would ask for any twins to come forward. These twins were usually taken away and kept in a separate enclosure where they would carry out all kinds of medical experiments. They would measure them, compare them, give them different drugs to see how they react to one another.
And when he'd finished with them, he'd always kill them himself.